from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G Scott and Ursula Royteam.
Chef, what did you say today was? By the way, I was in a good mood until you came up with a holiday. What's the holiday called?
Palindrome Day.
That got you in a bad mood.
This is just one of the, you know, chef.
Happy Palindrome Day, y'all.
3/22/23.
Oh. That's what that is?
Fun. Look, and the sun's shining.
Oh, yes. All right. Good morning, Ursula.
Good morning, G. As always, we invite you to connect with us on our state roofing text line, 888-973-5476, 888-973-CHIRO. We also invite you to join us on our G and Ursula Show Facebook page. And if you want to see us on camera, there are cameras all over here.
Cameras everywhere.
Yeah. You can check us out on our Chiro Radio app and, of course, on MyNorthwest.com.
All right. Right now, it's time to get to people with the won't. Ursula's top news stories of the day brought to you by Wayscar 40 Suzu in Auburn.
One person is dead and an Everett police officer is hospitalized right now after a shooting near a grocery store early this morning. We were going to join our reporter, Sam Campbell, who is at the scene, but there is a press briefing right now. But he was able to speak with Courtney O'Keefe. This happened outside of a Fred Meyer store. It was in the parking lot. And this is what we know.
What we know at this time is there was an officer-involved shooting. One Everett police officer was shot. That officer has been transported to the hospital. I can also confirm that there is a suspect deceased on scene.
And Courtney O'Keefe says that no other officers were injured. Let's hear some more.
No other officers injured. No other suspects injured. I do believe there were additional officers and additional suspects involved.
And there was a massive police response.
Everett Police Department responded to a 911 call. There was a shooting. An Everett police officer was struck by gunfire. That officer is now at the hospital. He is at Providence. There is a suspect also deceased at the scene.
So again, I mean, this was quite the chaotic scene. That Everett officer is still alive, is at Providence Regional Medical Center. We don't know what preceded all this. This happened between 3 and 4 a.m. You're hearing from the SMART officers because they are investigating several different scenes. Again, one outside the Fred Meyer store in the 8200 block of Evergreen Way, and then another at a car dealership next door. One person is dead, and they're describing that person as a suspect, but there were apparently multiple suspects.
I decided to take a different angle in talking about this today because sometimes I get to the point where you hear about these things and we're shooting here, shooting there. What we have been hearing a lot of is officer-involved shooting. We've been hearing a lot about that and over the time, especially over the last few weeks. So instead of, oh, man, that's sad. Oh, man, people are losing their mind. Instead of that angle, I wanted to go with another angle, Ursula. And I'm looking forward to our guest coming on at 9:33. We're going to have the executive director of Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. And we're going to be talking about the danger of law enforcement. I was reading, I went down a rabbit hole, the International Journal of Emergency Mental Health. And in it, it was talking about what happens when police officers are involved in an officer-involved shooting. According to this, this is back in 1991. So I hope that when Steve Schrank comes on our show, he can, maybe he's listening right now, he can give us an update to where that is. But this is something I never thought about. When officers kill someone, shoot someone in the line of duty, in 1991, 70% of them leave by 5 years after the incident, right? So I would assume that it's probably gotten better, technology, better mental health, better being able to therapy, being able to talk about it. But we already are talking about people leaving law enforcement. We're already talking about the recruiting issues that we have in law enforcement. You have those things going on. These officer-involved shootings, not maybe these officers, Ursula, don't leave law enforcement. But just imagine how long this stays with them for the rest of their career. that impact right there.
Now, if they are lucky enough to survive, and it sounds like right now that officer is at the hospital. We don't know the level of his injuries, but again, our prayers go out to the officer and his family. But, you know, of course, this shooting in Everett is the second one involving a local officer in just the last couple of days. We've been covering this other situation in Ballard the last couple of days. A King County Sheriff's deputy remains in critical condition at Harborview after he was shot while serving an eviction notice at a Ballard apartment. We do have some new details this morning. The King County Independent Force Investigation Team now says all three deputies likely returned fire when a tenant shot at them. Spokesperson Megan Black says it is standard procedure to have that many officers handle a single eviction.
I was told that there's a minimum of two and they prefer to have three in all of these situations because of the precarious nature. Nobody knows what is going to happen.
The 29-year-old tenant went by the name UC. The medical examiner says she died by a self-inflicted gunshot. Court records show that the owner of the apartment complex started trying to evict her last fall because she owed more than $6,000 in rent and utilities.
Wow. Again, it goes to show you, and I didn't know the response and how many officers that it would need, but I would assume it would need that many because we're talking about eviction, Ursula. There's a lot of people who can probably get desperate in that situation, but I thought the amount was more than $6,000. The fact that it's only $6,000 for this to all go down like that, knowing that we do have so many services that we talk about out here to help those that become unhoused. It's unfortunate that it escalated to this.
Well, and I do worry for the safety. And, you know, in this particular case, there are court records that show that, you know, this has been going on for a while. UC had been working with the Housing Justice Project, and they argued that she was financially unstable since the start of the pandemic. She was trying to get her technical degree in machining, and classes were canceled because she didn't have the degree necessary to be hired and applied to jobs with no success. She had no income, and she had stated in a court declaration, if evicted, I will be irreparably harmed as I do not have family or friends to help, and I'm facing homelessness. Mm. Now, the detective, David Easterly, is the wounded deputy. Again, he is in critical condition. And, you know, I read through this. And I read through the, you know, as desperate as you are, there is no excuse to harm others in your desperation. And that's where I guess my sympathy stops. But I also understand that given the pandemic, eviction moratorium, which was extended multiple times, I think we're going to see, I mean, it's just going to be that much more dangerous when you have to do these eviction notices. I mean, whether it's for officers, whether it's for the landlords, because I think there are going to be more people who are desperate right now.
Well, I'm with you on the part of where the sympathy stops, because just because you're getting ready to get evicted, by the way, I got a T-shirt for that. Just because you getting ready to get evicted, that doesn't give you the right to want to harm or try to cause harm to anyone else. So I agree with that.
Seattle landlords will be able to ask about arrest records and convictions, but they still can't refuse to rent to tenants because of that criminal history. This change comes after the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned a portion of Seattle's Fair Chance Housing Ordinance. In 2017, the Seattle City Council passed that ordinance as a way to reduce barriers to housing based on race. But in a lawsuit filed by some landlords, attorneys argued that they do have a right to ask questions that impact their tenant safety. The appeals court agreed, ruling that the prohibition was overly broad and constitutional.
I spent way too much time on this topic. And the reason why I did, because I was seeing how all of the loops that have been gone through with this thing and how it has not been very easy. The latest ruling being that it basically kind of opens the door for landlords to ask, to look into prospective tenants' criminal record, but they still can't make a decision on them living there based on what they see in that criminal record. This is very simple for me. Number one, allow all landlords to be able to know the background, in if that's criminal background, whether it's criminal background or their rental history background, on a prospective tenant. Number one. Number two, that landlord should be able to make the decision when there's other applicants that are trying to get there. I was thinking, if I own some homes and Ursula, and I wanted Lillian to go and check on some homes, I want to know if she is going to the home of someone who has a maybe they have a felony, and maybe that felony was violence against assault on someone, on a woman or something like that. I want to know if my wife is going to check on that rental property. So I'm all for it.
Well, so am I, but I don't think it goes far enough. So basically, you can know about it, but you still can't really do anything about it. You cannot. So basically, it means that, I mean, the Seattle Times spoke with someone from Columbia Legal Services who says this ruling likely means that landlords can ask about a prospective tenant's criminal record as long as they don't use that information to take, quote unquote, adverse action against the tenant. So basically, you will know about it, but that doesn't mean that you cannot rent to that person, right? Or you cannot, I mean, basically, you know about it, so you're just aware of it.
But it is hard, like, it is very hard for someone. So let's just say I have five prospective applicants. I have five applicants. Of those five, two of them have a felony. They have a record in what they have done, right? And the other three of them, they have no record or anything like that. But one of the guys, one of the, or gal, whatever, that has a felony, has a dog or has other things that I might decide to go with another application. Yeah. My point is, it's going to be very hard to really pin down someone for making a decision on whether or not they got it off the back, the criminal background.
Yeah, so this is seen as a ruling in favor of landlords, but it's a small step for landlords.
I think I think it's good. I think it's enough.
I do too. But I don't think.
What more do you want?
The right to deny a tenant for a violent crime.
Exactly.
For a violent crime.
Because
yes.
I can see why this law would exist. Because, hey, if I've had a DUI in my past, should I be able to be denied housing for that? If I have a pot conviction that I haven't had the means or opportunity to expunge yet, should I be denied housing for that?
No.
I mean, obviously, a landlord could still do a background check. They've always been able to do that. This just allows them to catch someone who lies about a criminal history, right? But a landlord could say, hey, your credit isn't sufficient. You've had an eviction proceeding in the past. But still, I feel like there should be a carve out that says, hey, if you've had a sexual crime or a violent crime, I should be legally allowed to prevent you from renting my house.
If you raped a kid. I really don't want you.
But they do give landlords that discretion.
No.
On sex offenders, they do. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, they do. Okay. Yeah. On sex offenders.
But in this particular case, they're just saying you cannot take adverse action against the tenant. Which, again, you know, people who are fighting for tenants' right or renters' rights say this is correct, and because we want to make sure that people aren't discriminated against because they've had a criminal past.
Mm-hmm.
I think, given everything, I mean, and there was a whole series of rules and laws that apply mostly to landlords that I think, again, has made it kind of one of those, I'd think twice about being a landlord in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. In all fairness, I actually think that the way it is right now, I think it's fair. I think when you start trying to go too far one way or the other, I think that's where things get a little gray.
Yeah.
But the thing that you guys are saying being able to say no to a violent crime. So
yes.
not rape. Let's say it's assault, domestic violence, or something like that. So you guys are saying an automatic no on that. I'm saying that can be subjective too, though. right? Mm. When it comes to assault.
And this is where I would want it to be the landlord's decision.
Because if I go out...
I don't want someone to force me to rent to someone I don't want to rent to. Because I fear for my safety or my tenant's safety, sure. I guess, bottom line.
Sure.
The middle class is moving out of King County. According to a new analysis of moving patterns based on credit scores, that income group moved more frequently than any other in the past two decades. And the Seattle Times reports they were more likely to move out of the country's wealthiest neighborhoods like Bellevue, Kirkland, Mercer Island, and Medina, where housing prices are the highest compared to South King County, for example. The Seattle King County Health Department was involved in this study. The authors concluded that high-income residents are now the new majority in King County. But one important thing to note about this study, and I want to get your take on this, is that it classifies residents with a credit score of 580 or lower as low income and a score of 750 and higher as high income.
I thought that was genius, a genius way to do this study. And I'd almost say, not sweeping statement here, I'd almost say that probably equates. If you go, most of the time, you go credit score and you go income, they kind of balance out to each other. Also what stood out to me is the growth rate of residential groups in King County over the last 20 years, the last two decades. 8.9% in the high credit aspect, but in the middle to moderate and low has been negative. Like, there has been zero growth over the last 20 years. So basically, King County is the place for affluent people. That's what it's come down to.
That's essentially what it's saying.
And also,
in 2021, King County's annual average wages grew 24% over the previous year. That was the highest jump in Washington. It's now $115,436 a year. And, of course, a lot of that goes to tech and finance workers that skew the average. But in terms of how you classify residents, whether they're low income or high income, I'm suspicious about this based on their credit scores.
I'm not.
Because I think that there are people who make high income, but who have lower scores because they have overspending habits. And there are people who might be, you know, in the traditional sense, considered lower or middle income, who do a really good job of balancing their finances and have a really high credit score.
Both, and you're right. Both groups have its outliers, meaning that I believe that you can be financially not doing well and have really good credit.
Yeah.
And I also believe that you can be doing financially well and have bad credit. You have outliers in that, but I would bet that for the most part, they all match up. Hmm. So when you start talking about 715, 700 credit score, I bet you it matches up right there in the middle, right in there. All right.
You know what they both share?
What's that?
People with low credit, no one's going to rent you a place.
It's a lot harder,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Got to look farther and farther.
Yep.
Still ahead, just how dangerous is it for officers serving eviction notices? And is what happened in Ballard this week that uncommon?
Ooh, I can't wait to talk to this guy. We'll do that next. Gene Ursula.
To the Gene Ursula Show. It has truly been a heartbreaking week for law enforcement in our state. On Monday, as we've been reporting, a King County sheriff's detective was critically wounded while serving an eviction notice in Ballard. And then early this morning, an Everett police officer was shot near the Fred Meyer on Evergreen Way. And we invited Steve Strand, the executive director of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, to talk about the dangers involved in serving eviction notices. Steve joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I just, first of all, want to say, my heart goes out to all of you in law enforcement, because I know weeks like this are especially difficult.
It is. And you mentioned the shooting in Everett this morning. And I'm also thinking about almost a year ago now that Officer Rocha was you know, killed in a parking lot at Starbucks up in Everett. And I can only imagine what that agency is going through as they're dealing with that. Sounds like really extensive incident this morning while the trial is actually going on for the murder of Officer Rocha. And, you know, what makes me think about this is, as having worked in law enforcement, it's always been an issue for the families of those who do this job as they leave each day, and having their partners and spouses and families thinking about, you know, their safety and concerned about them when they leave. It's always been an issue, but it's really been accelerated the last few years. And this is the kind of week when I know a lot of families, as they see their law enforcement members leaving for work, are thinking maybe in different ways. And that's difficult. That's part of the challenge. And I think we're all trying to work through it.
And I can't even imagine. And Steve, I did see you in an interview that you did with another news organization talking about the difficulties when it comes to serving eviction notices, something that we really, I think, as the public, don't really pay attention that much to until something goes wrong. But you've said it's one of the most dangerous things that law enforcement faces.
Yeah, and you know, it's an area of law enforcement that a lot of people don't know much about. It's a specific responsibility of sheriff's offices to serve civil process, and it's a really critical element of the rule of law and of the court system to provide notices and to serve warrants and to serve. That's why it's called civil process. It's all about the court and respect for the rules and the processes of the court. So it's really an extension of the court itself under due process. So it's really an important part of our system. And those who do civil process, having worked for a sheriff's office myself, for King County actually, the folks who do that, as you may know, they're providing more officers to the scene than they used to for some of these reasons, because of the increasing volatility of these contacts. And I shouldn't say shocked. I wasn't shocked, but it was jarring to me. I pulled the numbers. We have our statistics unit that does statistics for the state. And I asked them to run the numbers for assaults on officers in 2022 here in the state of Washington. And those numbers aren't final. They're preliminary. There's still some data coming in, but we saw an increase overall in assaults on officers in 2022 in our state over 2021 of 20%. So up 20% in just a year. However, in the category that includes evictions and civil process, the increase is almost 40%, 39% increase in assaults on officers. And I'm hearing that anecdotally from a lot of agencies as well, is that, you know, we've all been through a lot. I mean, certainly the pandemic, protests, all the changes and disruptions we've been going through in our society the last few years, as have with law enforcement officers. And that volatility, that willingness to resort to violence is present in so many contexts, including these kinds of contacts, which used to be relatively routine.
We're joined here by Steve Strand, Executive Director of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, here on the Gene Ursula Show. It's interesting that you looked that up, because, Steve, I was trying to look that up all morning and I couldn't find anything on that. So thank you for providing that. You know, no other non-military service group in this country is, you know, basically mandated to have to carry a lethal firearm as part of their daily equipment. And in doing so, we know that you guys have a dangerous job. You just mentioned the increase on assaults on officers and everything like that. And you also talked about a second ago, you talked about, you know, respect for the law and respect for the rules and everything like that. Can you talk a little bit about to that kind of impact and what you have seen, what you guys are talking about, the lack of just following the rules, the simplistic part of that?
Yeah. And it's, you know, I talked about the volatility and how I think officers and deputies are seeing more volatility and willingness to challenge, to run away, to not follow directions. Now, you know, I get it. I mean, it's not as if everyone has to automatically comply. I don't think that's ever been an expectation of everyone. There's always going to be issues with that. But just the numbers are increasing. The ubiquitousness of it is increasing. And, you know, I'll go back to the eviction contacts. It's a little bit like domestic violence, where officers and deputies are required to bring two really important things to that contact. And one is to be ready for violence. And as we saw in Ballard with King County Sheriff's Office this week, that occurred, even with three deputies there and even with all the precautions. However, it also requires a tremendous amount of empathy, because in a lot of those cases, like domestic violence, this is a person going through a very intense and emotional time, and it requires a lot of empathy. And every deputy who's dealt with these types of calls that I've ever known in my career, they generally are very, very empathetic people, because they need to be, because they're dealing with human beings that are going through a difficult time. And then to combine that with the increasing willingness we're seeing for people to use violence, including against law enforcement, that's a difficult mix. And I think we have to start to change that.
And how do you do that, Steve?
I think for us to, first of all, recognize that if it seems to you that we have too many of these things going on, it's true. They are. King County Sheriff's Office had a deputy shot just a few weeks ago in Shoreline. This is not okay. And I think for us to acknowledge, as things change, as the disruptions we've seen continue, we have to start to come together and come to solutions. I mean, I hope that doesn't sound too optimistic. No. But this, when a deputy gets shot, this should never be okay. This should be a big deal. And I appreciate you covering this, because the way that it affects not only the agency and the community, but our society is just toxic. And to see this kind of violence in the community and violence against law enforcement, while, again, we acknowledge the changes that we have to make in our society, I mean, I get it. We have to have a dialogue about this and not get in our corners. And to come together to, you know, build on these things and talk about why this is not okay and start to run these numbers down. Again, I don't mean to be too negative, but I was talking about preliminary numbers. Our homicides for 2022, the preliminary numbers we have, are right now at 384 for our state. Last year we set the highest number ever, 336. We're already for 2022, with more numbers coming in, we're already at 384. So we're going to blow right past that number from 2021. It's just tragic. Now, again, I don't say that to be negative. I'm saying this points to the fact that I think we really need to start to come together, solve these problems, send a message that we have to support good policing, you know, access to treatment, supporting people in crisis. That's a heavy lift, but that's where we are right now. And if you look at the conversations we're having out there, you know, in terms of policymakers within our communities, with your council and your mayor, we have profound problems right now with public safety. Mm-hmm. These are solvable. They're solvable by coming together. And that may sound simplistic, but that's really what it's all about.
Hey, Steve, the next time you come on the show, I have an idea. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring to the show some ideas in which we can continue the dialogue and try to push forward, because I think a lot of people listen to our show, and maybe we can have those discussions on the air together.
I would appreciate that, and I know that that's what the two of you focus on. It's one of the reasons I'm always pleased to speak with you, and I think that would be constructive, and that's exactly the kind of thing we should be doing.
Steve Strand, Executive Director of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, we always love it when you join us on the show. I mean, I'm going to say that I'm moved every time that you join us, because you have a lot of things to say that are very profound, and I'm just sorry for what all law enforcement is going through right now, especially this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on.
All right. Hey, coming up next here on the G and Ursula Show, yo, there's a new thing. Have you guys heard about it? It's called musical tourism. And you're like, what? What is that? Well, we're going to explain how some folks are trying to navigate the really expensive prices to concerts in the United States. We do that next. Gene Ursula. morning, everybody. It is the Gene Ursula Show. Matt Markovich is going to join us to talk about the legislature, and you guys know how good those discussions are. Well, but have you heard of musical tourism? Well, thanks to skyrocketing prices and red-hot resale market tickets for hot acts like, you know, Taylor Swift, Beyonce, which can cost thousands or maybe sometimes over $10,000, people on TikTok are figuring out that it's cheaper to buy tickets for a tour in Europe, including the cost of travel, than it is to buy just the ticket here in the United States. NBC News profiled two TikTok users who did just that, flying out to London and Stockholm to see Beyonce for less than it cost in Dallas and in Louisville. Ursula, we know that for some time that people have gone to for medical tourism and to go and get less or cheaper procedures done. The fact that this has happened is crazy. Here's a story. Mercedes Ariel, a content creator who's no stranger to the strategy. In 2018, she saw Beyonce and Jay-Z at the On the Run tour, tour in Paris, securing floor seats for $92 a piece. In her hometown of Dallas, the going rate for the same tickets were $900 higher.
Yeah, why is that? Why is she able to do that? Because here we have a monopoly called Ticketmaster, or what's the
dynamic pricing?
And dynamic pricing, mm-hmm. which sometimes you're a fan of. I think it's outrageous that you're looking at, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars to go to a, let's say, Beyonce or Taylor Swift when in Europe, there are some countries that actually do put cap and don't allow all these additional fees. And so because of that, these tickets are, I think her VIP tickets to the Stockholm show were $366. Then she basically used points and miles to get her hotel for free. So it was cheaper for her to go there. But, you know, the question is, and the head of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, I mean, they were grilled in Congress because something needs to be done. Unless you want all of these concerts, these especially great concerts, to be only for the rich.
There's a simple question in this, because there's one more thing that is common in Europe, and that is limiting what you can resell tickets for. Would you be okay with some constraints on capitalism in that context? Limiting how much you can resell your concert ticket for?
I know I'm picking and choosing, but in this particular case, I choose yes.
Same.
I would be okay with that because it's outrageous anymore.
Evan texts in, girlfriend just flew to Phoenix for Taylor Swift last week. It was cheaper for round trip tickets and the tickets to the show compared to just going to Climate Pledge.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. That's crazy.
But you know what I love?
Mm.
The ingenuity. The fact that people are you know, like, hey, you know what? I've got this big obstacle, but I'm going to figure a way around it, even if it means I'm traveling around the other side of the world.
I decided that, and I've been talking about this whole concert thing. There's no way that you should be having to be well-to-do to go to a concert. So I decided I'm not going to none of them. Beyonce, Drake, none of them. I'm not going because it's ridiculous.
Which is so strange because you are usually the person who goes to concerts. I'm going to three in the next few months, and that's outrageous for me.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're not going. I mean, Morris Day. I told you $55. So there are concerts you can go to.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay an arm and a leg.
Yeah, go see Morris Day. Morris Day. Who's Morris Day? You know, well, Purple Rain, 1985.
How about,
you remember
Purple Rain? Was it Purple Rain?
He was in Purple Rain.
Oh.
With Prince.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Oh.
I had no clue.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Coming up next here on the Gene Ursula Show, Matt Markovich is going to join us. And one of the things he's going to be talking about is this. Should you get your guns back after beating your wife and threatening her with a pistol? That should be hard to answer. It's Gene Ursula.